Our reading is taken from Luke chapter 23, reading verses 1 to 25. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king." So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracle. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there, vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who is inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." With one voice they cried out, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us!" Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again. But they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" For the third time he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will.
Good morning. Well, our sermon series has been building towards Easter, and today we come to the familiar final events that lead directly to the crucifixion. Do please keep your Bible open at Luke chapter 23. Of course, when we read the Bible, we're always thinking to ourselves, well, what must I do in response to what we've read? But with the Passion narrative, the significance is less about what we should do, but more about how we should be taken up in awe and wonder about what Jesus did for us to bring about our salvation. Lent is a moment to pause, to step back from life's relentless pressures, and to understand that Jesus willingly followed his Father's plan and walked the path of obedience and suffering. We're fascinated by trials, aren't we? O.J. Simpson, Gwyneth Paltrow, television cameras in UK courts for the first time, or the unattractive court of public opinion across the press or social media. After his arrest, in the space of a few hours, Jesus faced no fewer than six trials. three in religious courts before the three we have in our passage today, in a Roman court. But perhaps the question we should really be asking is, who was really in charge? As Jesus was passed from pillar to post and quizzed and questioned by the world's governors and kings, as he had said he would be, it all worked towards God's plan for our salvation. Behind the scenes, God was still in charge, and Jesus was the true king. As John Stott describes it, the story illustrates the interweaving of divine purpose and human action in the providence of God. Luke 23, page 1059 of our church Bibles. Well, to frame this, all the action takes place on Good Friday morning. Mark's Gospel tells us that Jesus was crucified around 9 o'clock, so everything we read will have happened between about 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning. To appreciate fully why the Jewish authorities were so angry with Jesus, we need to go back to the end of chapter 22, where things really escalated after Jesus said to the council of elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, the powerful Jewish elite, that he was indeed the Son of God. And Paul touched on those verses last week. At the end of chapter 22, Jesus is making three claims: that he was the Christ, the human Messiah the Jews were expecting; that he was the divine Son of Man from Daniel chapter 7, who will sit at the right hand of God and who will come in power to reign over the earth; and that he was the Son of God with a unique relationship to God. Hearing these claims and seeing Jesus as a threat to their religious system, to their way of life, and to their traditions, in response, the Jewish leaders clamored in verse 71 of the chapter before, "What more do we need?" They were worried about political and potential unrest, where the Romans might be upset, and they wanted to kill Jesus off. But because they were under Roman occupation, the Jews had no authority to carry out a death sentence. So they had to take the case to the Roman rulers. But the Roman governor wasn't going to be interested in trivial ecclesiastical offences against Jewish law. He'd only be interested in revolutionary claims which might threaten public security. So the charges against Jesus had to be repositioned as a political issue. So to appreciate the significance of all this, it's probably helpful to understand a bit more about who Pilate actually was, what his role was, and why Pilate himself was feeling the pressure. Now, Pilate was what was called the procurator. He was directly responsible to Tiberius Caesar himself. Well, sometimes, of course, people say to us that Christianity is, it's all made up, it's just a load of fiction. But recent archaeological finds confirm that Pilate was indeed a real historical figure. He'd become procurator a few years earlier in AD 26, and he had at his disposal both cavalry and about 5,000 soldiers. He normally lived in the administrative capital of Caesarea, but because there were so many visitors in the city, he visited Jerusalem during Passover to make sure the peace was kept. And Caesar needed peace in Palestine because it was a vital corridor of communication between the valleys of the Nile and the Euphrates. Egypt and Syria were provinces of immense importance, and Palestine linked them. So in his role, Pilate was expected to cherish the collaborators, to handle the ordinary people carefully, and to manage the petty rulers of the area with wisdom. But what was Pilate actually like? Well, the Jewish historian Philo describes him like this: corrupt, cruel, continual murders of people untried and uncondemned, never-ending, gratuitous, and most grievous inhumanity. In his few years in charge, he'd managed to antagonize the Jews by setting up Roman standards bearing images of the emperor in Jerusalem, which the Jews would have thought of as blasphemous. He'd used temple money to build an aqueduct, and he sent his troops in disguise to kill the Jews who'd been demonstrating. That is quite a CV. And his failings were well known to the emperor. Pilate simply couldn't afford another complaint against him. He'd had more yellow cards than a Watford defender. A bit like in The Apprentice, he was under the spotlight. So it was obvious to the Jewish leaders trying to get rid of Jesus that the best policy was to position Jesus as a subversive agitator. But the irony of this is that Rome had a worldwide reputation for the justice of its law courts and the impartiality of its legal procedures. So in verse 2 of our passage, we come to our three political charges, not religious ones: subverting our nation, opposing the payment of taxes to Caesar, and he claimed to be Christ, a king. But of course, the charge about taxes was complete tosh. We know that because only a few pages before, in chapter 20, Jesus had actually confirmed that taxes should indeed be paid to Rome. But the final charge, that was much more significant: an indictment of treason. So that is where Pilate concentrates. But the charge also made Pilate suspicious. The prisoner didn't look anything like a king. So Pilate wonders, what sort of king are you? And Jesus explains. His kingly rule, as we read in John's gospel, was to bear witness to the truth, and his kingdom was not of this world. So in verse 4, Pilate reached his verdict: I find no basis for a charge against this man. The ruling Roman procurator declared that Jesus was innocent. But the mention of Galilee in verse 5 gives Pilate an idea. He thought he could get himself off the hook by sending this Jewish preacher from Galilee to the Jewish authorities who oversaw that region. So that takes us on to trial number 2. Now, conveniently, Herod, like Pilate, was also in Jerusalem for the Passover. He was normally based in Galilee, almost certainly in Tiberias, a city which he had founded and built and which he had named after the Roman emperor. But now he's staying in the family pad in Jerusalem. And here's a picture of his second home. As an aside, it does rather remind me of a great chat-up line from Prince Harry. Now, I appreciate that this is probably the only sermon in the United Kingdom today with a quote from Prince Harry, but the story goes that when Prince Harry was a teenager, he said to a girl he fancied, "Would you like to come and see my castle?" But back to the Bible. So this is now Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great, who had ordered the massacre of all the baby boys born soon after Jesus had been born. This Herod was ruler, or tetrarch, over Galilee and an area called Perea, and he was pretty much a Roman puppet king. And his unpopular presence is a thread that runs through the Gospels. Most famously, his responsibility for the death of John the Baptist. But in Luke 9, we read that he wanted to see Jesus. Then he bobs up again in chapter 13, now wanting to kill Jesus, in a passage where Jesus described him as a fox. Tom Wright, in his commentary, pictures it a bit like this, a bit like the chief baddie meeting James Bond. You know, you can picture the scene, we meet at last, Mr. Bond. Well, here's a clash between the present and precarious king of the Jews with the real and coming king. Interestingly, Herod was actually of Arabian ancestry, and his family's claim to the throne was pretty dubious. Whereas Jesus, of course, was a direct descendant from King David, and that's why Daddy Herod had felt threatened by the birth of a Messiah in Bethlehem and had tried to kill him. But rather than trying to find out who Jesus really was, this Herod just wanted to be entertained. All he wanted was miracles and a magic show. For such a man who was clearly not to be trusted, Jesus has nothing to say. Herod just wanted Jesus on his own terms. And of course, many today aren't really sincere seekers either, but only interested in what they might get out of Jesus. And the silence of Jesus before Herod is a theme which links us back to the prophecy in Isaiah. Oppressed and afflicted, he did not open his mouth and was led like a lamb to the slaughter. Jesus remained silent before Herod and did not rise to the bait. And there's a lesson for us all in Jesus' dignified silence. So this is a picture of Sophie Clark, and she is one of the youngest of the 467 members that make up the General Synod of the Church of England, the governing body, the sort of parliament which they have. And this photo is of her making her maiden speech last month, in which she bravely stood up for the traditional concept of marriage, arguing that the bishops should continue to teach that the right context for sex was within the marriage of one man and one woman. And since publicly affirming that, she has been attacked and mocked in the courtroom of Twitter. But with wisdom and dignity, she has maintained a silence despite the provocation. And I'm delighted to say she gets married to Peter Ladd in 20 days and 1 hour's time, provided she's not late. So it's interesting, isn't it, that Jesus talked with Pilate but refused to speak with Herod. And it must surely be that Jesus realized that Herod was not serious about him. Herod had said that he wanted to see Jesus. But during the 3 years Jesus had openly been preaching and teaching in Galilee, Herod had been too proud to come to see him. It's an amazing parallel and repeat of the episodes with Herod's father, who had not travelled 6 miles from Jerusalem to Bethlehem to see Jesus when he was born, in direct contrast to the 900 miles travelled by the Magi. But Herod was quite smart and too practiced a diplomat to fall for Pilate's trick to stitch him up. This was a Roman responsibility. And when he didn't get what he wanted, Herod and his soldiers just indulged in rough mockery. Verse 11, dressing Jesus in what may have been one of Herod's own kingly robes, before returning the problem prisoner to Pilate. But fascinatingly, Herod had found Jesus innocent. Herod, who had killed John the Baptist, Herod, for whom Jesus had refused to do a miracle, still found Jesus innocent. And so in verse 13, we come to the third trial of our passage. And once again, Pilate pronounced Jesus innocent. Across the different parallel Bible passages, the most striking feature is Pilate's fivefold declaration of Jesus' innocence. Verse 4, as we saw, I find no basis for a charge against this man. Verses 14 and 15, I find no basis for your charges against him, neither has Herod. Verse 22, when the crowd demanded his death, Pilate declared again, I have found no grounds for the death penalty. And then in Matthew's gospel, there are two further powerful images, that of Pilate's wife sending the dramatic message, don't have anything to do with that innocent man. And finally, the famous account of Pilate washing his hands in front of the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. As the theologian George Caird put it, Pilate does everything in his power to secure the discharge of Jesus, short of discharging him. Maybe Pilate hoped that the people would side with him, or perhaps he thought a brutal scourging was enough of a punishment. But then we come to what must be the most ironic piece of the entire jigsaw. As the crowd, whipped up by the Jewish leaders, shout for a well-known revolutionary, Barabbas, to be released and for Jesus to be executed. And the irony was that Barabbas was guilty of some of the very crimes of which Jesus had been found innocent, stirring up the people and leading a rebellion. Barabbas, whose name, in yet a further irony, means son of the father. So here was Pilate. His role was to keep the peace in the region, but he was terrified of the lynch mob outside. And he had in jail a proven murderer, a dangerous and convicted criminal, and an enemy of Rome, Barabbas. And he also had in jail a man who he knew was innocent. One who stood for violent revolution, or one who offered the way of peace. One of them had to die. If you've ever been to an enactment of the Good Friday story, and there's one coming up this Easter at Trafalgar Square, you'll know the noise and the hatred of the crowd escalates, and you can see how you might get swept up along by it, making a frightening experience. Here, torn between justice and expediency, afraid of the crowd, faced with the intensity of public uproar, Pilate chose self-preservation and sent Jesus to the cross, the innocent punished and the guilty set free. There's a line in the hymn that we sang a moment ago, My Song is Love Unknown, which sums this up so powerfully. A murderer they save, the prince of life they slay. If anyone in history should understand what it was to have Jesus die in your place, it's surely Barabbas. Pilate had tried four ways to avoid this moment and to avoid this decision. He tried to shift the responsibility onto someone else. He tried to satisfy the crowd with half measures by having Jesus whipped. He tried to do the right thing, but for the wrong reason. He tried to use the Passover experience and custom to free Jesus as an act of clemency instead of an act of justice. And he tried to convince the crowd of his integrity by washing his hands of it all. And finally, we come to the chilling words of verse 24 and 25, which were the final two verses of our reading. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man in prison for insurrection and murder and surrendered Jesus to their will. So when Pilate and Jesus faced each other, one as judge, the other as prisoner, who was really in charge? Jesus, battered and bruised and mocked? Or Pilate, the emperor's powerful representative? At a human level, clearly it's Pilate, the Roman governor, who had declared, "I have the power either to free you or to crucify you." But from his seemingly weak position, Jesus displayed a deep strength and sense of purpose and a strange and compelling calm and determination. In John's account, when Pilate bragged of his own power, Jesus calmly explained that Pilate's power had been given to him from God. In reality, Jesus was the one in control with a steadfast mission to obey his Father. He had repeatedly predicted the manner of his death. He didn't have to go to Gethsemane. He could have gone out of town, but he deliberately chose to go to the place where he knew he would be found. He could have summoned up angels to his rescue. But as Philippians reminds us, he chose to be obedient even to death on the cross. Jesus knew that Pilate was part of God's divine plan. It wasn't Pilate who was in charge. It was Jesus. As Jesus said, "No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own choice." We may not be murderers or revolutionaries like Barabbas, but the Bible tells us we are all sinners who have fallen short of the glory of God. Jesus didn't just die in the place of Barabbas. He died for you and for me. Jesus is the one who took our place. It shouldn't be Jesus on trial. It should be us. In his hymn, Graham Kendrick summarizes it simply. "Amazing love, oh what sacrifice, the Son of God given for me. My debt he pays, and my death he dies, that I might live." So why did Pilate do it? Why was he such a moral coward? Why was he so weak? Now, John's gospel provides the answer. The crowd kept shouting to him, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar." It takes courage to stand up for what you believe and to stand against the crowd. It takes courage to have integrity. Just look at Kate Forbes, the Scottish politician at the moment. On Good Friday morning, Pilate had to choose between two kings. And he chose to be a friend of Caesar. And like Pilate, we too face a choice. We cannot serve two kings. I wonder who or what the other king might be for you. And straight from this trial with Pilate, Jesus goes willingly to the cross where he gave his life for us. Amazing love. Oh, what sacrifice. The Son of God given for me. My debt he pays, and my death he dies, that I might live. Amen.